Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. This is your show host, Randy Fine. So today I have a show that's going to pull together so much of what I have talked about and my guests have talked about on A Fine Time for Healing over the last 8 years that I've been doing this show. Whether you realize it or not, most of modern society's thinking is based upon a philosophy known as materialism. This is the notion that physical material, known as matter, is fundamental in the universe. It is the basis of all reality, and that everything is comprised of matter, and everything can be reduced to matter. Princeton magna cum laude graduate Mark Gober's book, Mark is our guest today, An End to Upside-Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. This book marshals in the clear evidence and makes the case that consciousness is the force that precedes matter, upending the scientific and popular belief that the brain or matter produces consciousness. Mark's worldview was turned upside down in late 2016 when he was exposed to world-changing science. He is a senior member of a Silicon Valley investment bank and strategy firm and former Wall Street investment banker. So we're going to find out how this finance guy, investment guy, ended up writing this book. So let's get started. I'm going to introduce you to my guest, Mark Gober. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Randy. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. It's my absolute pleasure. All right, so, big question. How did you go from your focus of economics to your interest in the invisible forces that govern the universe?
I'm very often asked this question. And actually, back in college at Princeton, I was interested in big questions, and I almost majored in astrophysics. But because I was on the tennis team and I was later captain of the tennis team, I was just too busy, and I couldn't do both astrophysics and tennis, so I decided to instead study psychology with an emphasis on behavioral economics. And then, as you mentioned, went into investment banking, first on Wall Street during the financial crisis, which was a very interesting time to be there. I started in July of 2008, so right before everything hit is when I started in New York. And for the last 8+ years, I've been with Sherpa Technology Group in Silicon Valley, where I'm now a partner. But it was 2 years ago when I first learned of the topics that I discuss in my book, and it was through podcasts. I was listening to health podcasts, and it was in August of 2016 where I heard the first one that kind of got me interested, and it was a woman who described her psychic abilities and her abilities to work with energy. And I had never heard of any of those things in a serious way where someone talked about how they could actually do them. And at the end of that podcast, the woman, whose name is Laura Powers, she said, well, I have my own podcast called Healing Powers, and I interview other people who have these abilities too. So I decided to download that podcast, and I would listen to it on my way from San Francisco down into the peninsula where my office is located, and I would just listen to her talk to different people in this area. And it got to the point after a few weeks of just casually listening, I wasn't taking it too seriously at first, but I realized that there were enough people who independently described personal experiences, and they came from many different backgrounds. So it got to the point where I couldn't understand how all these people were saying these things. I couldn't reason necessarily that they were all lying or that they were all delusional. So it led me to say, okay, I need to investigate this further, because if something is going on here, then I need to shift my worldview completely. Which, once I looked at the science behind it, which I didn't know existed, and I'm sure we'll discuss today, things like the U.S. government program. Princeton University had a lab run by the former dean of engineering, the University of Virginia, the Division of Perceptual Studies. I realized I needed to rethink reality, and that led me down the path of researching very intensely for a year outside of the office, which culminated in my writing a book in July 2017. I wrote it very quickly. After I had told enough friends about the research I was doing, they told me that the impact the information had was very positive on their outlook on life. And that kind of led me to say, well, maybe I should just try to put my thoughts on paper. Because before July 2017, or the summer of 2017, I had no plans on writing a book. It was just a personal interest project.
Interesting. That's very interesting. And, you know, the books that I've written, I had no plans on writing them either. The books kind of, they find us somehow and write themselves. It's pretty interesting how that happens. So this stuff is so up my alley, and it is the way I've been living my life for so many years. I have no doubt of so much of what you talk about in your book, and you cover really pretty much everything that is controversial as far as these invisible forces that govern the universe. But science, for some reason, is not grabbing onto this, even though there are so many legitimate studies that have been done in this area. Why do you think they're not willing to admit that there is such thing as quantum physics and psychic abilities and things like that?
I think about this probably daily. One reason is that we tend to be biased by what we can see with our eyes and what we can sense with our normal senses. And what we're talking about here are invisible forces in many cases, and they don't come up regularly. Sometimes they're very subtle, or sometimes they're not so subtle, but you can't put your finger on it necessarily and prove that it wasn't that's not just a random thing. So I think that is an underlying issue, number one. But also, I think we've seen this with many other phases in science where certain things just didn't seem to make sense according to conventional views, and they were resisted very heavily. So we can go back to the Copernican Revolution, where people thought that the Earth was the center of the solar system, and then Galileo came along and showed with the evidence in his telescope that actually the sun is at the center and we revolve around the sun. The clergymen were very opposed to this idea, and they actually wouldn't look in the telescope to see Galileo's evidence. So I think we have something similar right now, where the conventional perspective is that the universe is fundamentally made of matter. Our own consciousness and awareness is derived from matter in our brain, even though science admits we have no idea how that could happen. And Science Magazine calls it the number two question that remains in all of science. In spite of all that, there's an assumption that we are conscious because of our brains. And it seems to persist, and there's just major resistance, I guess, from those who have built their careers and their academic careers on that basis.
Yeah, good explanation. Yeah, I mean, for them to embrace this information, they'd have to abandon everything they know. And that's pretty difficult. And some people just have these scientific minds where, you know, everything is scientifically proven and those kind of things. But what's interesting is that there is so much science behind what we're talking about today. So let's talk about quantum physics. It teaches that the universe doesn't work in a way that aligns with our everyday experience, that there are seemingly invisible connections between objects that are physically distant, and that the mere act of observing something can affect physical reality. I've actually learned to do quantum touch healing. And when I took this workshop, so much of it was demonstrated so that we could see what was happening with our eyes. There was no doubt about how quantum energy works. So talk to us a little bit about that, about quantum physics.
This is a really important topic because this is now accepted science, and it's been around for over 100 years. The issue is that it is so counterintuitive, and it typically happens at the ultra-small scales of reality, that we haven't necessarily incorporated it into everyday society. Our society works on a Newtonian paradigm. You drop an apple, and it falls to the ground, gravity. It's a very easy thing to understand. And the Newtonian paradigm has done very well, and it's a very good approximation of what reality is. The problem is that it's not a 100% accurate picture. And when we get into the quantum realm, that gives us an even more accurate picture. Some of the phenomena there, one you alluded to, is known as entanglement. And this is something that Albert Einstein did not like, and he tried to disprove it. He called it spooky action at a distance. And the basic phenomenon is that when you have two particles that are physically distant from one another, when you affect one, the other one is affected instantaneously. And the reason Einstein did not like is he thought the speed of light was the fastest that anything could travel. And here we have two things at a distance, sometimes very large distances, and there's an instantaneous connection. That's faster than the speed of light. But that is proven to be real, which suggests that there is some kind of hidden interconnectedness going on in the universe. And some contemporary scientists like Dr. Dean Radin from the Institute of Noetic Sciences, he wrote a book called Entangled Minds, which is the notion that entanglement might apply to our minds, especially if our minds and our consciousness is not confined to our physical bodies. So that is one really, really important area of physics that has been proven, and I don't think it's been incorporated into our everyday science and even medicine.
Well, I think it's the way science is going. Yeah, I think eventually it's all going to be quantum science. Okay, I'm sorry.
I agree with you. And even in the area of technology where I work, quantum computing is becoming a very big thing, where we're using the applications and we're using the ways in which it can be helpful, but I don't think philosophically and existentially we've necessarily incorporated the implications yet.
No, you're right.
So another really important area of quantum physics, it's a phenomenon that has a complicated term. It's called the collapse of the wave function. And basically what that refers to is a study where when the observer is looking at the experiment, the particle that is being observed, it behaves differently. So when you're not looking, the particle behaves like a wave of probability, meaning that it's maybe here, maybe there. It's not in a definite location. But then when you look, it collapses into being in one location. So it's suggesting that the act of observing, and some argue the consciousness, is playing a role in shaping and steering reality. And so this has been a very controversial topic. If you look back at the early quantum physicists like Max, who won a Nobel Prize, people like him said, well, we think consciousness, this is showing that consciousness is playing a primary role. And he even said, this is a direct quote, "I regard consciousness as fundamental." And he regards matter as derivative from consciousness, whereas the conventional thinking is that matter creates consciousness. This quantum world is suggesting that consciousness is actually steering our physical reality.
Well, I believe that. I do believe that. I think consciousness is everything. I think the universe is consciousness. You'd say that consciousness is your sense of being you, and it is your sense of experience in life. So when you say, "I am reading this book," you could regard I as consciousness. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm often asked, well, what do you mean by consciousness, Mark? And it's really a subjective experience. So right now you and I are talking, Randy, and there's this subjective inner experience that is aware. And it's not a tangible thing. But that sense of experiencing, that sense of identity is the consciousness that I'm referring to. And this is the big question that, like I said, it's the number two question in all of science, according to Science Magazine. In philosophy, it's called the hard problem of consciousness, which is that we know we are having a subjective experience. The question is, how does that arise from physical matter? We have no idea how that could ever happen, while at the same time, we've learned how to build smartphones and we've learned how to send people to the moon. We still don't know the origin of our own consciousness, which is incredible to me.
That is incredible. Yeah, and perception is something... I've been very interested in that for a long time because a lot of what causes conflict is the fact that we think everyone perceives the world exactly how they do. And that's absolutely not true. Perception is everyone has a completely different reality. And I know that you talk about perception in your book. So you say we can use our everyday perceptions for an approximation of reality, but not a 100% accurate picture. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think in one sense this relates back to the quantum versus Newtonian perception of the world, where our perceptual systems are not detecting everything that's in this quantum realm of the ultra-small versus the Newtonian, which is things that we can see on a normal scale. So that's one. But another is to think about the brain and the body as so I'm not arguing in my book that the brain and body have nothing to do with consciousness. I'm just recontextualizing their roles.
Okay.
I regard the brain as being, instead of a producer of consciousness, it's like a processing mechanism or a filter or an antenna, to give a very crude metaphor, that is processing something that exists outside the body. So that means that our brain and our body, they are processing some consciousness that's not localized to us, and therefore the way that our brain is configured will impact the way that we perceive the world.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, so you know, the brain is the processor. The consciousness comes through the brain, and the brain processes it. It's just phenomenal what the implications of all this. The other thing that I think is really interesting and you talk about in your book is time. And you say Albert Einstein's most well-known theories has to do with relativity, which suggests that time, how fast or slow one's clock goes, is not fixed. Instead, it is relative. How do you see time? I know that we live in a linear world where time is very important to us, but time is a physical world concept, right?
Yeah, this is a really difficult one because the human mind, the way we perceive things using our biological machinery, likes to look at things in linear time. We think of a past leading to the present, which then leads to the future. But if we think about this conceptually, and this isn't even getting to some of the studies that we can discuss on precognition, which is knowing the future before it happens, that puts things into question. But just conceptually, the past is a memory. We think it exists as an absolute thing, but it's a thought that occurs in the present. We cannot prove the existence of the past, and the same thing goes for the future. It's a thought that occurs in the present. So really all that we can know is just a now. And this relates to my idea of how I think about consciousness, as we've discussed, as being the primary force, more primary and fundamental than matter, and existing beyond space and time. So that means that if things that we perceive to be happening in the future, it's possible that our consciousness could almost reach forward because it's beyond time.
Interesting. And, you know, I've actually extended time. I've tried to do this, knowing these things, knowing that it's not necessarily a real thing but a perception. If a couple of times I was running late somewhere and I just asked for time to be extended so I could get there on time. And it worked.
Mm.
Really blew my mind.
Well,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so it does. And it's not something you can see. because if you're looking at a clock, you're looking at your watch, if you're not looking at the second hand or the seconds going by, then it's very difficult to see. The minutes seem to last longer as I'm watching them on the clock in my car. So, again, perception. It's very interesting. And this also leads into what you call the butterfly effect. And I know that this is a real term. And this talks about the fact that the world operates in a nonlinear fashion. So can you explain a little more about the butterfly effect?
Sure. This is a really important point, which is, like I mentioned, our mind likes to think about time as a very linear thing, past to present to future. Our brain is configured in a way for us to like things to be very easy to understand and linear. However, the world does not work in a linear fashion, where very, very small changes in the initial conditions of something can have massive effects later on, even if the initial effect is very small. So what's known as the butterfly effect is the notion that mathematically a butterfly flapping its wings in China can cause a hurricane in the Caribbean, because the initial conditions have been changed a very, very slight amount, and the effects end up becoming nonlinear or some kind of exponential change. So why is this important? We tend to think of things as being linear, where if I push the door with a certain amount of force, it will respond in accordance with how hard I push the door. The butterfly flaps its wings. It affects the air molecules just a tiny, tiny bit. We would expect a tiny, tiny effect on the weather if things were linear. But in fact, when you do the math, which our mind is not computing all at once, when you actually do the math using a computer, you end up getting much bigger effects from that very, very small change. So this is all to make the point that our universe does not work in intuitive ways. It's actually a very nonlinear universe, even though it appears to be linear.
That's wild. That's a really interesting thought. And so what do you think about thought thought is energy, and it is said that our thoughts can affect everything. They can affect change. They can cause problems. So thoughts are energy. And do you agree?
Yes, and I think in terms of the science to suggest that that is true, there is a field of psychokinesis study where people's mental intentions, which I would equate or make similar to their, have an effect on the physical world around them, which suggests that there is some kind of a transmission. And I'm not sure we know exactly how it works, but the way someone is thinking can have an actual physical effect on the world, even if it's very minor, without a physical contact made. It's some kind of energy or force that we don't fully understand that is having an effect on things.
And it's interesting because I'm not a religious person, nor is this a show about religion, but prayer or meditation, really. I mean, meditation would be a non-denominational way of talking about that. But that's why prayer, I think, is so powerful. Because it puts these thoughts out there, and especially group prayer. So it can change. It affects change because of that.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So let's see. There's so many things. I took so many notes here. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the psychic abilities, telepathy, precognition, mediumship, things like that. So you touched on these things. How much of this has been scientifically proven?
Well, if you had asked me this question 2 years ago, 2+ years ago, I would have said there's no evidence. I've never heard of anything in my education. I studied psychology even. We didn't talk about psychic abilities. But in my research, I realized that there is a whole body of evidence coming from different areas. And I'll start with some of the, I think is maybe the most compelling, which is that the U.S. government has run many studies using psychic spies. And the phenomenon is known as remote viewing, which is the ability to perceive something without seeing it with your eyes. So it's like you're seeing it with your mind, something very far away. You're able to see it in your mind. That makes no sense under the conventional perspective that consciousness is limited to our bodies. But if consciousness is kind of everywhere beyond space and time, it's like people are able to access something at a distance. Well, the U.S. government and the CIA have recently declassified documents from around the Cold War era. There was a nearly 20-plus year program that they ran using psychic spies. And these are direct quotes from the documents. Remote viewing is a real phenomenon. Implications are revolutionary. Evidence too impressive to dismiss as mere coincidence. So that on its own, I mean, when I look at that, I'm a business guy and I have to look at evidence for business cases. I don't really know how to get around something like that. When you add to it that in 1995, Congress and the CIA asked a prominent statistician to look at the evidence for psychic phenomena in various studies. She came back in her report, and she was later, in 2016, named the president of the American Statistics Association. So this is someone who knows statistics. She says, using the standards applied to any other area of science, psychic functioning has been well established. And this is in a publicly available report that she provided for the government. So that's pretty compelling. And then on top of that, Princeton University ran a lab, which I didn't know about when I was there because it was so controversial, run by the former dean of engineering, Dr. Robert John. They ran over 600 trials on remote viewing, and they suggested that it was real as well in their studies. So just looking at that alone, I think that's pretty compelling.
It's very compelling. And as far as, psychic abilities, such as mediumship, I've had several mediums on my show. As a matter of fact, I have one who comes on every single month and does readings for people on air. I've had readings done of me, and my life, and it is unbelievably real. The things that come through are very, very specific. Nobody could possibly know most of it. And a good medium will not take any information about you or even your phone number. You call them so that they can't do any prep on, on who you are. And that's really a good way to know that what's coming through is authentic. But it's absolutely real. I have no doubt, or I wouldn't continually have this person on my show.
I agree with you. And as part of my research, when I initially got into this, I looked up some of the mediums that resonated with me and people with these abilities to know things at a distance. And I did sessions with people, and they were able to come up with things that they could not have known through regular means. And that was aligning with the research that I was doing. And for example, the Winbridge Research Center studies mediums. And these are people that are focused on communicating with the deceased. And the studies have been they have five levels of blinding. So these are tightly controlled experimental conditions where the medium is over the phone and all that's given to the medium is the first name of the deceased person, and the researcher is the one on the phone. So it's not even the person who lost a relative. So you can't claim that that person was giving subtle cues over the phone. It's the researcher giving the first name. And what's been shown in two peer-reviewed journal studies, we need more research on this, but I think that's compelling on its own. Five levels of blinding, the mediums are able to get non-chance information, just knowing the first name over the phone.
It's just an incredible gift. So then let's talk about near-death experiences, because we all have heard of near-death experiences. And what's so interesting, and I know this has been studied extensively, that the experiences are very similar. The stages of the NDE are very, very similar to each other. So what have you discovered or learned about near-death experiences?
This is a really important area, and I'm glad you brought it up. I wish more people studied this and knew about what happens in these experiences, because it's very enlightening in terms of the meaning of life potentially. But so the near-death experience has been reported since the old times, since the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Plato talked about it. But it was a now-and-then reported phenomenon because resuscitation technology wasn't as good. now, since the 70s, we've gotten really good at bringing people back from things like cardiac arrest and other things. So the number of near-death experiences reported has gone way up. So there's a better ability to study these things. The near-death experience, these are instances in which a person has severe physiological trauma. They get in an accident, and their brain is either highly impaired or it's completely off, like in cardiac arrest. We know when someone's in cardiac arrest, they're technically clinically dead, and blood stops flowing to the brain after a certain amount of time. So in these cases, if we accepted the conventional view that the brain is producing our conscious experience, with an impaired or non-functional brain, there should be limited or no consciousness at all. And yet people report a highly lucid experience. They're hovering over their bodies. They're being enveloped by what they call an unconditional love that they can't even describe with words. And that's, I think, part of the problem, is that words apparently do not do justice to the experience. They talk about a life review, and this is really important. So they describe experiencing their whole life in a flash, where they see and feel all the things that they experienced. But to me, this is one of the most significant findings that I've looked at, is that during the life review, what some people report is that they actually take on basically the eyes and the body of the person that they affected during their life. So let's say Bob harmed Jane during his life. He was really mean to her. During the life review, he might experience that event through Jane's eyes and feel the pain that Jane felt, which, again, if we're part of one big consciousness, that actually makes sense. It's like shifting lenses. But Bob will come back from the life review, and after the near-death experience, forever changed, because all of a sudden he realizes life is not about the material things. What he judged himself for, and it's him judging himself in the life review, he judged himself for how he treated people.
Yeah, you know, it is. When you come to understand this, embrace it, believe it, it really takes the fear out of living, because we know that we go on, and how real that other world or other dimension that we go to is, that we're very much alive. I find that to be very comforting. Okay, and the other thing I wanted to talk about is Dr. Ian Stevens' research, because I know I've read some of this, and it's about reincarnation, where children have remembered previous lives, and then it's been studied. The information they give has been checked out and found to be true, locations, things like that. Mm-hmm. So, you say they study more than 2,500 children. Him and Jim Tucker of the University of Virginia study more than 2,500 children over 50-plus years who claim to remember previous lives.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's really incredible. And these are prominent scientists, near over 50 years of research at the University of Virginia. And these are reports from children who are usually between the ages of 2 and 5. And the reason for that window is that before the age of 2, the children usually can't speak at all. And after the age of 5, either they feel like it's not acceptable to talk about these things, or they kind of lose the memories. So it's a small window where the children are able to speak, and they're openly speaking about it. And they describe a life that is not theirs. And sometimes they even have preferences that don't make any sense, like craving tobacco or alcohol or fearing water, when we find out that the person that died in the previous life drowned, for example. So very specific things. In some cases, the children, and this is very rare, but it happens, the children speak languages that they were never taught. It's known as xenoglossy, with an X. I mean, these things are very difficult to explain using conventional means, and the researchers in some cases have been able to find medical records that match what the children are describing about what happened to the person in the previous life. So to me, actually the most compelling cases, because some people make the argument, well, maybe what's happening here is that the children are psychically picking up what happened to someone who used to live, but it's not actually reincarnation. It's just a psychic ability, which on its own, compared to the conventional views, would still be revolutionary. But if we want to argue that it's reincarnation, which I lean in that direction, is that the children sometimes have birthmarks and physical deformities that match how they describe dying in the previous life, which suggests that something is being transmitted that's not physical, it's not genetic, it's not environmental, that is impacting their physical form, that might just be another form of consciousness that they used to inhabit a different body. And, you know, when the children are describing a very specific death and they have physical birthmarks and deformities that match what happened in that previous life, some of which are verified by medical records, there's a very strong correlation there. And you could explain that easily by the notion that there was a previous life, the consciousness transitioned into a new body.
Well, I don't know if you ever read Brian Weiss's Many Lives, Many Masters,
very, very –
have you read it?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a good one.
That book is mind-blowing because for those who have not, what happens is that he's regressing one of his patients, taking her back to another time. And he has another patient who he regresses, and it turns out that the two of them were together in this past life because so much of what they experienced correlated with each other. So, and they knew nothing about each other in this life. So it's very, you know, there's just so much about this. It fascinates me. You're not the only one. But I like the fact that you're presenting this in a scientific way because, like I said in the beginning, for those who don't grasp the woo-woo, this puts it out there in a scientific way. So allows people to understand this and to take part, embrace these aspects of consciousness into their lives, which brings so much more fulfillment. And
I agree with you.
Yeah, and you also talk about organ transplant patients that sometimes they take on the memories and personalities of their donors. It's not a brain transplant. It's an organ, a heart, a lung, liver, whatever it is.
Yeah, these are amazing cases. And the reason that I mentioned these in the book is to demonstrate early on, and this is in Chapter 2, that there are many phenomena that exist that are suggesting that the brain is not what's producing the consciousness. And one general point before we get into the organ transplants is that we see reductions in brain activity that are associated with heightened experience. So like in a near-death experience, the person has no brain function or minimal brain function, and yet they have a heightened experience. Someone takes psychedelics, they have reduced brain functioning and a heightened reality. That matches the idea that our brain is like a filter, and these events sort of unlock the filter. Step further and say, well, what if we put in an organ that's not the brain and put it into someone else's body? And if there is a transfer of memories, then that's suggesting that something totally independent is happening that's also impacting our consciousness, and we see that in some cases. And there's a good book called The Heart's Code by Dr. Paul Pearsall, who's a psychoneuroimmunologist. But he talks about some cases that are very specific, where a person has an organ, sometimes it's a heart, that is not a brain, it's transplanted into another person, and that person takes on specific personality traits and even memories. And then the most compelling case to me, or the one that stands out in my mind, is a little girl who had a heart transplant. And in many of these cases, they actually don't even know who their donor was. But in this case, the little girl got a heart from someone who was murdered. And she started to have nightmares about a man who came to her and murdered her. And she actually saw a psychiatrist because her mother was concerned that she had these dreams. And they realized, wait, the girl got her heart from someone who was murdered, and the psychiatrist took notes on the man that the girl was describing in her dreams. And they were so detailed that they were able to give those details to the police and find the person that murdered the girl who had the original heart, which is amazing.
That is so compelling. That is so amazing. I love that. Love that. I hear that siren. Okay. So I've mentioned a lot of things about the book. we just have a few more minutes left, but what is there anything that you specifically want to say, talk about from the book that I haven't covered?
Maybe generally. The reason that I wrote the book the way I did is exactly what you described, which is that I think we need the general scientific community and also to the everyday person who just has never been exposed to these things. And our society is trained to look at things in a scientific manner where what did the study show? That's how people want to look at things. So I was very careful in the book to pick things that were compelling to people who look at it through that lens. And for that reason, I didn't mention the Brian Weiss studies that used hypnosis, because the University of Virginia researchers have said that that's less reliable, even though there are some compelling cases. So I was very careful. That's just one point I want to make here, is that I was careful about the science that I selected for that reason. Another point that we haven't mentioned is that, you know, I'm often asked by people, well, I don't understand this, Mark. Don't we already know that the brain is related to our conscious experience? Isn't that just like a known thing? Like, if someone gets in a car accident and they damage their brain, then they have memory problems or their behavior changes. Like, so don't we know that the brain produces consciousness? And this is the key point that, you know, we might look back in the history books a few hundred years from now, or hopefully sooner, and say, I can't believe that they made this mistake. The mistake in saying, well, that the fact that there's a relationship between the brain and the conscious experience, we're presuming that it means that the brain produces consciousness. The potential error there is known in statistics as correlation does not imply causation. So there's an example from Dr. Bernardo Kastrup. You have a fire and lots of firefighters show up. A larger fire, more firefighters show up. A strong correlation between the size of the fire and the number of firefighters that show up at the scene. We know that the firefighters did not cause the fire. We might have the same mistake in logic, brain, and consciousness. Strong correlation between the brain activity and the type of conscious experience, but it doesn't prove that the brain produces consciousness. So this is the piece of logic that I'm hoping to expose in addition to all the evidence, is to really put a question there of, okay, correlation is not telling us that the brain produces consciousness.
Very interesting. And we're going to end the show on that note because we are just about out of time. But I'm talking today with Mark Gober, the author of An End to Upside Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. So, Mark, where can we get this very fascinating book?
My book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and many bookstores. And also, my website has more information, which is markgober.com, markgober.com.
Okay, perfect, perfect. So this book has so, like I said, it has so much in it. I'm like, oh, that? Oh, yeah, I know about that. Yeah. But I love the fact that you bring all the scientific evidence and all the studies and things like that. So for anybody that really wants to know about this stuff and wants proof that it exists, this is the book for you. Thank you, Mark. It's been absolutely fascinating. I've enjoyed having you, and thanks for being my guest.
Yeah, thank you, Randy. It's a pleasure.
Have a wonderful day.
Same to you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. So we are out of time for today, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randygfine.com, RANDIGFINE.com. I hope that you will join me next time for more of A Fine Time for Healing. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's programming. To learn more about Randy Fine, read her articles, or to make a counseling appointment with her, please visit randygfine.com. That's RANDIGFINE.com. Or visit her on Facebook at Randy G. Fine.